It is time for the single coolest sports show in the country, The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics.
You've got Matt Bonner, who my notes tell me is a sandwich blogger named Red Mamba. I mean, how can you not like a guy like that?
And the Red Rocket knocks down the triple.
Red Rocket, telling you, Red Mamba might not miss a shot.
Just like in politics, in the instructional video business, you need credibility.
You want credibility? I'll give you credibility. Hey, Tim, what's my nickname?
The Red Rocket.
No.
The Sandwich Hunter.
No. Fry Gun.
The Medium Fundamental.
And welcome to The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I'm Chris Ryan here in the great state of New Hampshire. I believe Matt is back in the 603 as well, as he's been traveling about, as have I, just getting back from Quebec. We spent a couple days up there in Hemingford, Park Safari, Montreal. And also Zoo de Granby, as it was a trip of a lifetime for the young Ryan boys. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Great. Appreciate joining us for the show. Apparently, we're both doing better than Kyrie Irving's doing. And, you know, things can change pretty quickly in the NBA. We've found out that Kyrie is disgruntled. He's unhappy, apparently, playing in Cleveland. He's asked for a trade. And so now we have seen a dramatic shift in the Celtics fandom over the past week, where now the Celtics are all of a sudden having a great offseason and things are looking good, where before, not so much. Now, I remain, Matt, I remain skeptical of where the Celtics are at until, you know, we see what and if Kyrie Irving is traded for. Because if you're going to trade a really good player, you know, even if you're in a situation where they're asked to be traded, you're likely to get a pretty good haul in return. So that remains to be seen what exactly, you know, the Cavs get in return. But it's a pretty interesting situation that the Cavs and Irving find themselves in right now.
It is. I mean, I don't know. It's you go to three straight finals, you win a championship, you're playing with the greatest player of your generation. And it's not like Kyrie Irving isn't a big part of that. You know, he's an all-star. He's taken over games.
Leads the team in
three to win them the championship.
Like, leads the team in shots and 25 points per game.
He can have much bigger of a role and more of a spotlight and more success than he's had with the Cavs in the last 3 years since LeBron got there. So it is a little surprising.
Yeah, and that's kind of a red flag to me, too, if I'm a GM and I'm thinking about, you know, trading for Kyrie. Certainly, he's one of the most talented players in the NBA, and I think, you know, almost everybody would be willing to put together an offer to trade for Kyrie Irving. But, you know, if he doesn't like that situation that he's in, and that is a situation that, you know, would appear to be a really good one, from the outside, what is going to happen if he faces some adversity in his new situation? And is, you know, that the type of guy still that you want to build your franchise around, seeing that, you know, he's in a situation of instability in, you know, a what would appear to be from the outside? And I'm certain that there's some things going on there on the inside that they're making it not so.
Yeah, there has to be something. Has to be something else that no one else knows, right? I mean, I'm not sure what adversity, you know, like I said, you've gone to three straight finals, you've won a championship. What adversity is making you want to leave that situation? You know, I'm sure only Kyrie can answer that.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
And you look at it, too. I mean, they're going to see a transition there at some point over the next couple of years where it is truly going to become his team as well. And I think that, I mean, we've seen signs of that already, as we mentioned before. I mean, he takes the most shots on the team. He averaged 25 points per game. He is their scorer, and he's one of the best players in the league. It's not like he's in a situation where he's, you know, taking on being a role player at 25 years of age. I mean, he's been given every opportunity to lead there, and, you know, there's been talk of LeBron potentially opting out of his contract after next summer. I don't think that's going to happen, but potential, you know, exists there. But for some reason, there just appears to be, I think, just a rift of some sort that exists between James and Kyrie. And there's also been the strange, you know, situation with the general manager's role there, and you know, whether LeBron wanted the last guy to go, or whether the whole thing is kind of strange for a team that, you know, at face value would be everything that you'd want—a team that can contend each year, a team that has a chance to win each year, and is there, and it's just a year removed from winning a championship.
Yeah, and for all those reasons, that's why it's surprising to everybody who's, you know, involved with the organization and who's covering this story. It's just a surprise. It seems kind of out of nowhere, but there's so many different factors that go into why you play, where you play, where you want to play, if that makes sense. And maybe we just don't have the whole story.
Right.
I don't know.
Right now, who do you think, what teams do you think have won, you know, the offseason as we sit right now in, you know, late July? Which teams do you look at and say, okay, they have done a lot to make themselves much, much better?
All right. Off the top of my head, obviously I'd say the Celtics have gotten better. I would say the Warriors, just by keeping the band together, kind of won the offseason, getting Durant to take that much less money so they can re-sign Livingston and Iguodala and re-sign Durant. And didn't they re-sign Pachulia too?
Mm-hmm.
And added solid role pieces around that. I think them just being able to kind of maintain status quo is a huge win and kind of makes the rest of the league play catch-up again this season. I would say Oklahoma City, obviously.
That's what I was thinking, yeah. And the Rockets.
It's hard. You hit right off the top. Yeah, the Rockets, obviously, too.
Yeah, they've been trying to pull off a trade.
Chris Paul, yep.
Oh, they got Chris Paul. They're trying to pull off the trade for Carmelo Anthony as well. So that would...
That would be super interesting to me, just because there's only one ball, you know?
Right.
Yeah,
I don't...
Carmelo, Chris Paul, and James Harden all on the same team.
Right.
And obviously James Harden and Chris Paul are great playmakers and get a lot of assists, but it'd be interesting to see how they figure out how to all play together on the offensive end of the court.
And the personality side of it would be interesting as well, where they all have, you know, very strong personalities. And as you mentioned, they like the ball in their hands. Is Carmelo ready to take on kind of that, you know, Paul Pierce shooter type role and let, you know, Chris Paul and James Harden be the facilitators? Or is he still going to want the ball in his hand? So, I mean, that's a deal that if you're the Rockets, I think you you want to make it. You're looking at the Warriors, you're looking at the Spurs, you're looking at the Thunder, you're looking at the Wolves being competitive in future years.
Yeah, the Wolves too. We didn't mention
they had a really good offseason. So I mean, we've seen, in my view, even a further shift than in the past to the West being the power conference, where in the past you could look at maybe a couple teams in the East being able to be in the top, you know, four or five in the Western Conference, but I'm looking at the Rockets, the future for the Wolves with Jimmy Butler joining that team, and Tom Thibodeau, you think perhaps being able to establish some sort of a defensive identity with them, and giving Russell Westbrook in with the Thunder, you know, somebody to play with for the first time since Durant left. So I think that all those moves are pretty significant and further kind of change the balance of power, because you're taking Paul George out of the East, you're taking Jimmy Butler out of the East, and putting him in the West.
It's kind of a snowball effect, too, in the East, I feel like, because you got all these teams that are either rebuilding or probably want to start the rebuilding process, but then they're looking at all the other teams in the East and are like, it's almost like, can we...
Right, we can finish fourth.
We're not going to lose these teams, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I would even throw the Raptors in that category.
Right.
Like, in their off season when they're trying to decide what to do, it's like, well, do we start rebuilding? Yeah, but are we going to really be able to outlose some of these other teams to make it worthwhile, you know, worth the short, worth the pain? Maybe, probably not. So we might as well do what we can to try to keep this thing going. And same with other franchises in the East. Like, you know, in a normalized league, there would be, you know, surefire top five picks going into the lottery. Instead, they're like, hey, we could make the playoffs. So it's interesting. That kind of side storyline is interesting to me.
Yeah, it really is. It's The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. Come to the middle segment of the program. We'll do some Red Sox. Talk with Red Sox starter Drew Pomeranz, and also look into the success of Red Sox catcher Sandy Leon in catching Chris Sale. And Sale, a guy who never shakes off Sandy Leon. Whatever Leon puts down a throw, he throws it. And we'll hear from Sale as well as Sandy Leon on the success of that duo. And coming up in the final segment of the program, Patriots offensive coordinator Josh McDaniels and Bruins Brandon Carlisle and Granite Stater Timmy Schaller, who's rejoining the Bruins this year, signed a contract earlier this month to play with the Bruins once again this season. A story that continues to stick with the Red Sox is that of David Price verbally confronting Dennis Eckersley on the team plane a couple weeks ago. And, you know, I'm curious from your perspective as a former professional athlete and now a member of the media, you know, your takeaways, because, you know, as we've talked about before, there's kind of this fine line that you know, former athletes have to walk in terms of their criticism. And Price and other players in the past have taken exception to what Eckersley has said. And Eckersley is, I think he's a fabulous analyst, because you can clearly tell his passion for the game. He's in on every single pitch. He wants to be there. He enjoys it. He lives and breathes the game, but he doesn't really have a filter. So he'll say whatever comes to his mind. And this was one of those circumstances where they put Eduardo Rodriguez, who's having a rehab start, they put his numbers up and they were bad. And he said, yuck. And Price was in the clubhouse. He saw that. And he's like, what's this guy doing? Why is this guy, who's supposed to be a former player, criticizing us like this? And Price's assertion is that Dennis Eckersley doesn't know how hard the game is, which is crazy, because if anybody knows how hard baseball is, it's Dennis Eckersley. Gave up, you know, the home run to Kirk Gibson and came back and has had a number of successes after failures. So I think Dennis Eckersley is more qualified to talk about how hard the game of baseball is probably than anybody. But anyway, and obviously still making it to the Hall of Fame. So I'm curious as to, you know, your takeaways and how, you know, you try to bridge the gap between and how athletes need to kind of bridge the gap between offering analysis that the fans, you know, want to see, and candid analysis, but also, you know, trying to give the benefit of the doubt to guys because you know how hard the game is.
Well, first of all, you always have to be fair and reasonable. You don't want to just come out be mean or a jerk. You know what I mean? Like, you know the difference when an analyst is breaking down something that's bad. You know, a player didn't have a good game or is in a rut. And you can analyze it in a fair and reasonable way, mm-hmm. and say, look, you know, I'll use Kawhi Leonard as an example. And this is totally hypothetical, but you could say, look, Kawhi Leonard, the last 10 games, has been in a shooting slump, hasn't been able to find his stroke. But then you can always try to make it positive and be like, but, you know, his overall career stats suggest that this is going to turn around. He just got to keep his confidence, keep working hard in practice, get extra shots up, and he'll get out of it and be back to normal. Versus, you know, an analyst who can be a jerk and mean and just, you know, go after a guy. And some people even make it personal. So that I don't agree with at all. But you still have to be fair and reasonable with any critical analysis of former teammates, players, whoever. But you know, you know, Chris, you hear announcers and you're like, man, this guy's being a jerk or something like that. I don't subscribe to that. And a lot of people do that I think to get attention, maybe it helps their career, their broadcasting career, because it garners attention, it gets headlines.
Right.
I don't know what the motivation is. Maybe it's personal from when they played against each other. Who knows? But I kind of try to keep it professional and fair and reasonable. That's always kind of my mindset when I'm having to analyze stuff that's not necessarily positive.
I don't know who you're referring to specifically, but I'll guess. And I'd say Charles Barkley and Shaq both kind of fall into that category, where at times it seems like they do things to either A, gain attention, or B, because they have some sort of bitterness towards, you know, another individual. And the example that's been used the most is how Shaq has gone after JaVale McGee and constantly picks on him to no end. And Barkley at times come across that way as well. Eckersley, I don't think, is in that boat. I think that Eckersley, again, he's overwhelmingly positive, to be quite honest. But I think the problem is, with any analyst, and you referenced it there, is if Kawhi Leonard's parents are watching you, or Kawhi Leonard's, I don't know if Kawhi's married at this point, but his wife is watching you, and they see this, and they're like, well, Matt was picking on Kawhi again. He doesn't have to bring this up. Kawhi knows he's in a shooting slump. Why does Matt have to say that Kawhi has not shot well the last 10 games, and anything else you've said is taken out, and they just pick that part out of context, and they go back and they run to Kawhi, and they say, Kawhi, this is what Matt was saying about you, and that's
That's not fair.
But I think a lot of
that happens. That's not fair.
I think that's
if
what happens.
Important.
I think that's what happened in this circumstance.
Factor, yeah, I mean, if it's an important factor when analyzing a game or a player, if you don't talk about it, you lose credibility as an analyst.
Right.
You can't have it both ways.
And that's why I think there has to be communication,
I think
too.
If you're fair and reasonable and generally positive, you can do that without offending too many people, I guess.
But right.
It seems like no matter what you say, somebody somewhere is always offended. But, you just do your best and be, like I just said, just fair and reasonable.
And I think the other key in concluding here with Matt, and we get to Drew Pomerantz and Sadie Leone and also Aaron Sanchez from the Blue Jays just a second here, I think the communication is the other key, where rather than doing what Price did and making a scene and mocking Dennis Eckersley as he walks on the plane and then telling him to get the F off the plane, how about you have a conversation about things and try to understand, as opposed to handling it the way that you did. And if that's not satisfactory and you want to make a mockery and show what a good teammate you are, well, fine. If that's what you want to do, then you can do it. But I just think that it was handled in a way by Price, which was extremely immature. I mean, if you have a problem, or if Kawhi has a problem with what you're saying, or Manu does, I would assume that they're going to talk to you before they're going to try to, A, because they know you, and you have a relationship, but B, that's just because it's the right thing to do. And it's up to, in my view, it's up to Eckersley and, Price to kind of to establish a relationship, because this story is now a month old, and it's still being, the details are still being hashed out. And I think that, there has to, whether it's the organization organization has, they've said they've dealt with it internally and that they've moved on. But you still have, whenever Eckersley walks in on the plane or wherever he's on TV, there's a huge tension that exists that doesn't have to if people just communicated with each other. And to me, that's the key in any of these circumstances.
Yeah, and when you're a professional athlete, you're always going to have members of the media criticizing you no matter what. And it's always been the advice I was given during my career. You just ignore what the media says. Like, who cares? You're always going to have, when you're winning, you're the greatest thing since sliced bread. When you're losing, you're complete garbage. So just ignore it. Focus on yourself, your team, what you can control, and who cares what they say as well. So that mindset goes a long way, too.
Matt, as always, appreciate you joining us for the show. We'll talk to you again next week.
All right, thanks for having me.
All right, it's The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Conqueror. The Phoenix is going to interviews in the next couple segments of the program. Stay with us. We catch up with what's going on the Red Sox and also look ahead to the Patriots and Bruins seasons here on The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I am Chris Ryan. We'll come back with more after this. Welcome back. This is The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I am Chris Ryan. This segment of the show powered by Revision Energy. What can sunshine do for you? Well, Chris Sale has been the best pitcher in the American League this year, and right now is the odds-on favorite to win the American League Cy Young. He's 12-4 on the season, the 2.48 ERA, first in baseball to get to 200 strikeouts, and has been flat-out fabulous for the Red Sox this season, even better than advertised. And one of the big reasons for his success has been his catcher, Sandy Leone. Leone has caught Sale in each start this year, and Sale has not shook off Sandy Leone, to my knowledge, once this year. In other words, Sandy Leone puts down a pitch to throw, and he throws it. Here's Chris Sale on Sandy Leone, the unheralded catcher who has been a big key to his success.
You ask anybody in here, he works his tail off. I'm not there for any of the scouting reports or anything like that, so that's all on him. And him reading hitters before the game and during the game as well. So I have a lot of trust in him. I have a lot of faith in him, and I should. I think we've had pretty darn good thing going, so I'm just keep trusting in the process and keep trusting in him.
Here's my conversation with Red Sox catcher Sandy Leone.
Chris, I was talking the other night about the role that you've had in his success this year, and just what is it like to have the type of control that you have with a pitcher that he gives you, and what's it like to have him, as the all the weapons that he has that kind of at your disposal to do what you want and to game plan and to have basically complete control over what he wants.
I mean, I'm the one calling the game, but he's the one throwing the ball. So, I mean, the way he's been throwing the ball all year and in all his career is impressive. I mean, he can throw every pitch in any count. And, I mean, when you're calling the game, I mean, that give you, a lot of options. Just, mm-hmm. I mean, you can call any pitch in any count. You can execute a pitch. And that's the way we've been working this season. I mean, he's been executing pitches. He's been doing it all year. So, I think I'm gonna say, it's really good, and working with him is, it feels really good.
It's rare to have a pitcher kind of relinquish control and say, okay, here it is, I'm not gonna shake you off and just go with it. What's that responsibility like? Do you like that, or is it kind of some extra weight on you to make sure you get things right and you do put down the right signs in the right spots?
I like it, man. I just want to be prepared before the game. I mean, whatever team we're facing, I like to watch the hitter. I like to know what team we're facing. And then, like I said, he's been executing a lot of pitches. Of course, we made mistakes. I made mistakes calling the wrong pitch. But, that's part of baseball. You just gotta learn from that and then just keep working.
Did you know coming in that this is the way he was and that you were gonna, have complete control over the game and he wasn't gonna shake you off at all, or did you learn that as you got to know him?
Not really. I mean, I got in a couple of times in spring training, maybe three times, and then I thought it was only in spring training. You just wanna get the game faster. And then, after that, in the first game of the season, I like to check. I just going with whatever you call. So I was like, okay. And then after that, I just preparing before the game. Whoever the team we're facing, just learn about the hitters, about the guys we're facing, and just go from that.
Do you think that's more pitchers should maybe, adopt that approach where it allows him to kind of clear his mind and just execute pitches and not overthink things and just kind of trust the catcher? Or does each guy have to kind of do what he thinks is right?
I mean, I don't mind when they check because everybody's different. I mean, sometimes it can be wrong, sometimes they can be wrong. That's baseball. So, Porcel is different, Price is different, Rodriguez is different, Drew is different, Bowman. So, I don't mind. They know what they're doing too. So they really prepare. They're really good doing that. So I don't mind when they check. I rather be on the same page with the guys and then just calling something they want to throw,
At what point did you notice that things really clicked with you and Chris? You caught him obviously all year, and it looks like that trend is going to continue. Was it something that happened instantly, or is he just really easy to work with given the fact that he put so much trust into you?
I mean, like I said, I just want to call the right game for him. And like I say, he's been executing a lot of pieces the whole year. So I'm gonna give all this except for him. I mean, he's been great.
All right, Sandy Leon right there. You look at the Red Sox this year, and they're in first place, the record of 55-45 as we speak here on Monday, 2.5 games ahead of the New York Yankees. And the reason for that has been, in my view, their pitching and defense. The offense has struggled to fill, particularly the power void, with the absence of David Ortiz. But you consider that this starting rotation was going to be a strength in spring training, and the fact that it is perhaps exceeded expectations with the pitching of Drew Pomerantz, the way that Price has come off of the injury, notwithstanding, the fact that Chris Sale has been the best pitcher in the American League, perhaps the best pitcher in baseball. Eduardo Rodriguez has been good. And you know, Rick Porcello, the American League Cy Young Award winner last year, has 13 losses, and that's really not indicative of the way he's pitched, particularly lately. He's a 4.52 ERA overall. Stephen Wright has been injured. But overall, the Red Sox rotation has been better than expected. I talked with Drew Pomerantz, who surprised some with the way that he has pitched, particularly when there was the consideration that he was perhaps continuing to deal with a nagging shoulder injury. He's 10-4 with a 3.51 ERA this year.
One of the top starters this year for the Red Sox has been Drew Pomerantz. And really, you know, the starting rotation, we talked about it in spring training, as being really the key to the team. And it has been. And I'd say guys' performances have been even better than expected. What's it been like being a part of this rotation on a night-to-night basis?
It's been great. Rick's had kind of the bad luck bug, but he's been pitching pretty well. As a group, we've all been doing pretty good. You know, getting Price back, you know, at any point in the year is great. And we got Eddie back going, so we're kind of getting everybody back on the right track back for this, this stretch through the second half.
What have you liked about your performance kind of continually through the months of May and June and now into July?
I think I worked really hard. I had kind of a shortened off season, and, you know, as everyone knows, and kind of got a late start on a lot of things, but throughout all of it, I was still working on, you know, just kind of refining everything and pitching both sides of the plate, and just becoming a better all-around pitcher. And I kind of had a good start to the season, and then had some had a few rough patches there, and then but kind of brought it all back together, and really just been a lot more consistent with all my pitches. And I think that's a bit huge key for me, is trying to be in the zone and throwing quality pitches.
And that seems to be, for most pitchers, that's right where they need to be. Trust the stuff, get the fastball, hitting the spots, and then use that off-speed stuff to keep guys off balance. And that's really been the key for you. Hit spots consistently with the fastball, and then got guys out consistently via the strikeout or leg contact with a breaking pitch.
Yeah, throwing strikes when you need to, fastball, elevating when you need to, throwing off-speed for strikes when you need to, and being able to, expand the zone out and then down. Just making the right pitches. It's really something I was really working on, and trying to stay out of the deep ball counts that were, getting me out of the game even sooner.
You mentioned Porcello, and baseball is such a funny game, where last year, obviously, he was the Cy Young Award winner, deserved it, but he got great run support on a night in, night out basis. And, the record was indicative of that. And then this year, as you referenced, he hasn't pitched as well, but really over his last handful of starts, he has pitched well enough to win, but the luck just hasn't gone his way. And how do you judge a pitcher, a starting pitcher, in what they're doing? Is it just based upon feel, what you're seeing, whether guys are getting light contact, or do you go by traditional stats like ERA or wins and losses?
He's been great all year, and you can always narrow it down to one or two pitches, and sometimes you get those one or two pitches by the guy, and sometimes you don't. Like me the other night, I had one pitch to Gary Sanchez that really, without that, home run, it's a different, different kind of outing for me. But, it's just one of those things that we can't control. So we try to keep a simple approach. We put in our work every day in between. We go out there and we try and make pitches, and, whatever's going to happen, the runs, we can't control how many runs we score, but we just got to try and give it our all, and keep us in a good position to win or have a comeback win.
Sale was talking about how excited he was to pitch here against the Yankees, and that there was a palpable energy. There were some Yankee fans here, as Red Sox. It was a fight for the division after the All-Star break, people getting into baseball. What was that energy like for you, and how much are you excited about pitching in meaningful games here, you know, down the stretch?
It was pretty awesome this series here, you know, having four games in 3 days. You know, the fans really came out, and it was probably the loudest I've heard, other than my debut here last year when against the Giants, when the place was erupting. You know, it's exciting, especially when we get arch rival here in Boston with our fans. You know, it's, you know, us, you know, first and second division. It's an exciting game. You know, it's going to be an exciting stretch to the rest of the year.
No question. And final thing, you know, watching Sale, one of the most amazing things is that he puts complete trust into Sandy Leone and the game plan, and kind of just lets everything go and clears his mind and just executes pitches. Is that something that, you know, that you think about as well, and that maybe more pitchers should, you know, think about? Like, you think about relief guys, and they just kind of execute their pitches too. There's not a lot of shaking off that goes on. Do you feel that that's maybe a direction that more pitchers should go in and place a little more trust? Or do you think you have a feel for the game and your stuff's, you know, everybody's stuff's a little bit different than Chris Sale's?
Yeah, you know, pitching is all about throwing the ball with conviction. If you don't, you know, if you're not totally sold on that pitch, you know, things cannot go well for you. You could throw the wrong pitch at the wrong time and throw it with conviction and still, you know, still get away with it somehow. But, you know, he trusts Sandy, what he's calling back there, and he's totally committed to it. And that's, you know, that's what it's all about. You know, that's why guys shake. You know, you maybe think, oh, you know, and, you know, I don't shake Baskey that much. I do it a couple times a game. Then we talk about what happened, you know, if I should or I shouldn't have, or, you know, it's, you know, for the pitcher yourself, it's all about, you know, the conviction, you know, you're more convicted throwing this pitch over another.
Drew Pomerantz right there. Aaron Sanchez was one of the leading pitchers in the American League last year in consideration for the AL Cy Young Award, but this year he has struggled with consistent problems on his hand, with blisters, fingernails, you name it. He started against the Red Sox last week, and I talked to the former New Hampshire Fisher Cat, what seems to be a very frustrating season.
How would you kind of categorize the year so far? Has this been your most frustrating season, particularly given off of what happened last year, or no?
No, not at all. I mean, you can't control those things. I'm not going to get carried away in that. I'd go crazy if I did. It was one of the things that I dealt with this blister all year last year, and it's flared up in start number two, and I had 28 in my mind more starts, and I couldn't, you know, keep battling that. Like I said time and time again, this game's already hard enough, and when you're out there trying to focus on something and not focus on the hitters, you're going to find yourself not having a lot of success. So that's kind of where I was at when I made the decision. And then after that, you know, a split nail, a blister, those are things I can't control. So just is what it is.
Yes. Start before coming here to Fenway, you like the fact that you pitched to light contact throughout the course of the game. Is that how you and light contact and no contact during the course of the game? Is that, you know, where you want to be when you're dominant? That's what you're doing. You're keeping guys off balance.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like that. I pitched well against Houston before the All-Star break too. It was just one of those things where, you know, the first two guys, I don't think the ball got to the infield. A couple calls here and there, things might have been different, but, you know, I took the good from that, moved on, and anytime you get weak contact and not a lot of hard hit balls, you're lining yourself up for a good night. So if I'm doing that, then I'm pleased with what I'm doing out there.
How do you feel about pitching at Fenway? You had one of the signature starts of your career last year when you pitched this team into the postseason with a fabulous performance here. Is this one of your favorite places to pitch, or how do you feel about taking them out at Fenway?
I mean, I try to go into every start the same. All the history and the crowd that, you know, comes out every night is fun to pitch in, that atmosphere. So I wouldn't say I like it or dislike it, because I take every start kind of similar in terms of how I prepare and how I work. But it's definitely a lot of fun, you know, getting to share the field with some of the greatest of all time, and having these fans show up, you know, every night is pretty fun to pitch in.
And finally, Chris Sale mentioned the fact that he really feeds off the energy of the fans. Some pitchers will say, you know, they don't want there to be too much energy because they, you know, want to keep focused on what they're doing, the game plan, and executing pitches. Do you like having, you know, more energy, more excitement in the stands, whether it's, you know, up in Toronto or here?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it doesn't matter. You know, you go out there with a mindset and a kind of perception of how you want to attack these hitters, and it's just about a game plan, is what I was trying to think of. You go in with a game plan, and you just try to execute it. You know, regardless of, you know, all the commotion, regardless of if there's plays made and not made, calls made, not made. You know, you try to just keep your composure and go out there and have fun. When you're able to have, you know, fans screaming in your face, we've got the luxury of doing that, you know, the last few years, you know, making it into the playoffs and having a strong fan base up in Toronto. So it definitely does get the juices flowing a little more, and it's definitely helpful, you know, in those tough situations where, you know, there might be runners in scoring position and, you know, you need to punch out to get out of the inning, and, you know, that extra chaos that's kind of going on, you know, will pump you up to get you through that predicament. So for me, it's fun. I try not to put too much stress into that. I just go out there and try to execute what I'm trying to do.
Continuing on with the Blue Jays now, if not for an individual by the name of Aaron Judge, and if the Blue Jays were playing a little better, so two big ands, Justin Smoak would be in the conversation for the American League Most Valuable Player. He's hitting 300 on the season, 27 home runs, and 64 RBIs. This after seasons in the past in which he hit 217, 226, for the Toronto Blue Jays, and never had a batting average above 238 in a season.
Just talk about what this fit has been like for you. Obviously, the production's been there. This lineup's been a good lineup for you to hit in. What about, you know, Blue Jays has really agreed with you and produced this type of a season?
I think a lot of it, you know, has to do with the work that I've put in, but at the same time, getting every day at bats too. I think that always helps. Just consistency, like being in there every day. And you know, it's been a good year. Just got to keep it going.
It's so important to have, you know, an organization obviously that believes in you and gives you a spot. And that's probably one of the big reasons that you've obviously had success this year outside of the, you know, the work you've put in. And guys will talk all the time about how, you know, they try to stay ready and they'll do what they can if they're not playing. But playing every day obviously gives a huge advantage and allows for guys like yourself to achieve that potential, correct?
Yeah, I mean, and I'll be the first one to say I have so much respect for the guys that don't play every day, that get in there, you know, twice a week, three times a week. I mean, that was definitely not easy for me. I feel like my first year here, I did an okay job at it the times I got a chance. Last year I didn't, but, you know, I just felt like, you know, just the consistency of being in there is, you know, it lets you know that, all right, I'm going to get four or five at-bats today, or, you know, no matter what I do today, I'm going to be in there. Like, it's one of those things. And, you know, so that, for me, utility guys that, you know, play against lefties, or guys that just play against righties, I mean, that I've got the utmost respect for those guys.
Talk about playing, and not just playing, but starting the All-Star game at 30. And we had, you know, Stephen Wright here last year, who went through so much to get the opportunity to make it to the All-Star game. What does it give you a different, you know, perspective, kind of entirely, to, you know, go through what you've gone through, so to speak, and then achieve that and be a part of things as a starter?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great honor. It's something that, honestly, and I've said it the whole time, for me, I felt like that was going to happen from day one. I mean, you know, to be drafted where I was drafted, to, you know, to be a prospect. I felt like once I got to the big leagues, that was just, you know, that's what was supposed to happen, and it didn't happen that way. And so, you know, to be able to do it now, 5, 6 years after being in the big leagues, I mean, that's, you know, it just kind of makes it probably feel that much better.
And it seems like, you know, each player obviously has the belief in their ability that, you know, wherever they are in the minor league system or in a major league team, that their time is right then. And, you know, they don't necessarily see what an organization might see in terms of you have to be patient, or there's guys ahead of you, or, you know, a lot of the things that take place. But it seems like, you know, baseball kind of has a way of always, you know, working out where the guys who are supposed to rise kind of do. And your story seems to be one that kind of is indicative of that.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, honestly, I feel like the way the game is now, I feel like what's kept me around is that I could play defense at first base and I could hit homers, and that it's honestly what kept me around. And, you know, it's, yeah, you can hit homers, but it's the, you know, 1-for-4 with a homer, I used to be okay with that. And, you know, that was a good day. But, you know, and now, you know, I've gotten to where I don't try to hit homers, and I've hit the most I've ever hit. So it's, you know, something that you know, something you learn from, and, you know, I feel like I've done that.
Yeah, and in concluding, I mean, that's what a lot of guys do, too, is, I mean, they look at, if you're in the Red Sox system, if you're in the Blue Jays system, you're like, well, what do I need to do in order to make the team? What do I need to do to stay on the team? And guys will adapt their game, particularly their approach to the plate, in order to, you know, try to fit that mold of what is, you know, popular in baseball or what's going on. And is that something that you see in a lot of players, where there's obviously some guys who can just do what they do and be, you know, successful, but guys will try to adapt to the times in terms of how they approach? 13 Red Sox, obviously a great example of home runs and walks and so forth.
Well, I mean, if you look throughout the whole American League East, I mean, a lot of the games you win are by hitting the 2 or 3 run homers. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, and it's around the league now, too. I feel like, you know, strikeouts are up because guys are trying to hit the homer, and homers are up because guys are being able to do that. And so it's, you know, something that, you know, for me, my whole life, until I got to the big leagues, I never tried to hit homers, and I hit them. Mm-hmm. You know, once I got to the big leagues, I tried to create power. I tried to generate power, and it didn't work for me. I feel like I'm big and strong enough that if, you know, I square it up, it's got a chance. And, you know, it just, you know, took me longer than I expected to take me to get to that point.
That's Justin Smoak. This is The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. That segment of the show powered by Revision Energy. When we return, Patriots offensive coordinator Josh McDaniels. Welcome back here on The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. This segment of the show presented by the Prescription Center, where the health of you and your family comes first. So we are running out of time once again on the program today. We'll get to the Bruins guys next week on the show. Brandon Carlo, as well as Timmy Schell, our conversations with them, as we have some time before the Bruins get set for a training camp in September. So we'll hear from them coming up next week on the program. Right now, though, my conversation at the Hampshire Motor Speedway in Loudoun at the race last weekend with Patriots offensive coordinator Josh McDaniels.
What commonality do you see between, you know, being the offensive coordinator, game planning for a football game, versus what these guys do to get a race car ready for an event?
That's the thing I think I was drawn to the first, you know, is that they have a team full of people they have the shop, they have the crew, they have all the strategy that goes in with the crew chief, the driver, the setup of the car. That's basically like what we do during the course of the week and get ready for, you know, each game. And you know, ours are weekly and theirs are weekly. And they got to make decisions on game day just like we do. So I have a lot of respect and admiration for that. And I really love the team aspect of this sport.
It seems like it's all-encompassing, too, you know, what they put in during the shop. And that's pretty similar to what you do in season. Is it pretty much, you know, when you're game planning, when you're getting ready, going from game to game, is it pretty much all-encompassing? That is your life?
Yeah, I mean, you work, you know, 16 to 20 hours a day sometimes during each day of the week leading up to the game. There are no days off once football season starts for us. And, you know, our lives are dedicated to trying to figure out the best way to try to play each game. And I think that's what they do.
How many times have you watched the Super Bowl since it happened?
Just a couple times. You know, obviously reviewed the game film and all that, but, you know, it's a memory that we'll have forever. It's a special team, special group of people, and we're looking forward to starting our process all over again. You know, we're all 0-0. Nobody's accomplished anything yet, and we're looking forward to getting started here in a couple weeks.
How much do you enjoy the process? Because that has to be, you know, a big thing for a coordinator, and particularly working for Bill Belichick, is you have to be all in on the process, and, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, and then 2 + 2 = 4.
Yeah, you have to love that in order to work at this level, and I don't know that I've ever felt like I've had a day of work in my life. You know, it's hard work, it's long, it's tiring, but I enjoy it so much that I never think of it that way. So enjoy the challenge. Look forward to getting another season started this year.
Each year you look at the team and the fans are like, okay, you won a championship this year. Look at the guys they added. We expect growth from this guy and this guy. James White after the Super Bowl, he's going to be a Pro Bowl type guy. How do you look at, you know, the different weapons that you have at your disposal this year? It must be fun, but obviously, again, the process is the process.
Yeah, you stick to the process of getting every player better. You know, that's as long as we focus on that and try to improve each man, then usually our unit will get better. And, you know, we have a lot of guys we count on, and every one of them is just as important as the next. They all have a job to do. The great thing about football is very similar to NASCAR. If one of the 11 guys out there on the field doesn't do something right, generally we could have a bad play. And so whether that's a pit stop or something in the shop during the week or what have you, everybody's role is important to winning and losing. And we got a group of guys that are willing to put in the work.
And in concluding, I mean, that's really the strength of the Patriots, whether it's Chris Hogan, whether it's James White. You can call the number, and you obviously count on Tom Brady to be there day in, day out, but you can call the number of anybody on that roster and allow for them to have success on the offensive side. And you could, that must be such a joy to game plan for. If we want to use Gronk down the middle or Bennett last year, you can do that. If we want to go deep with Hogan. I mean, yep. Edelman is obviously always there for you. That's a great thing to have, is to have those weapons at your disposal.
That's why we work so hard, and that's what we build for in the offseason and training camp, is to trust each other. And when you need to, you know, when your number's called and we need you to perform and step up, you got to do what's expected of you. And we have a lot of faith in our guys.
It's Patriots offensive coordinator Josh McDaniels. This has been The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. That segment of the show brought to you by the Prescription Center.